Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of great science and great music. I'm your host, Jorge Salazar. This is a scientist soundbite.
It's the body's own way of sort of conveying how we feel. So we should trust ourselves and our bodies, and when something feels right, well, it's a sign that this could be a good thing.
In the studio now is Lindsay Patterson, here to tell us about a new book by Cheryl Kirshenbaum, a research associate at the University of Texas at Austin, on kissing.
So you are just listening to Cheryl Kirshenbaum. She has a new book out on one of everybody's favorite subjects, kissing. Her book explains why we kiss, what happens when we kiss, basically everything that scientists know about kissing. So I talked to her about some of the things she covered in her book. So let's start with the most basic question. Why do humans kiss?
Humans kiss for a variety of reasons. There's the biological reasons, the reasons that it's good for us. Things like assessing a partner, figuring out how compatible you might be, getting a sense of who they are and whether you might have a future together.
What can two people tell about each other from a kiss?
Well, when we kiss, we engage all of our senses. So we're learning so much about a person, not just visually, as we're so used to in terms of, you know, dressing up to go out and thinking about how we look, but we're also engaging our noses, our taste buds, the sense of touch. And through that information, all sorts of signals are being sent to our brain telling us about the other person. So some of them are obvious, you know, do we like how we feel when we're with that person? Do we like the way that they're holding us or whatever it may be? But also olfaction, our sense of smell, well, that can tell us a little bit about how compatible we are. And scientists have actually found that women tend to prefer the sense of men who have a distinct genetic code for immunity from them. And that's something that we subconsciously pick up when we're in very close proximity doing something like when we're engaging in a kiss. And so in turn, you know, people who have a very diverse genes for immunity would down the line potentially have children that are stronger and healthier. And so it's sort of like nature's litmus test. And that's one of several examples of how a kiss can tell you a lot about your partner.
Mm-hmm. So there's things that we are aware of. You know, I like the feel of this, but there's also things that we might not be aware of that these little mechanisms in our bodies are actually picking up on.
Yeah, it's neat. And actually, according to evolutionary psychologist Gordon Gallup, who's at the State University of New York at Albany, 59% of men and 66% of women say they have ended a budding relationship because a kiss didn't go well. I think there's a lot to say that you have so much riding on that first kiss with someone or that for those first few kisses with someone, where if the chemistry is right, it might start something with the person you least expect. But even when everything looks like it's perfect, if the kiss doesn't feel right, well, something might be off, and it's your body's way of saying look elsewhere.
So you write in your book that there are chemicals exchanged in a kiss. What are the chemicals and what do they do?
Right. Well, there are a variety of different chemicals in our body influencing the way we feel and helping us decide what to do next. For example, oxytocin, it's known as the love hormone. And oxytocin gets stimulated in our bodies when we're in close proximity to someone, when we're kissing, and through a variety of other behaviors that might come later. And that's responsible for feelings of attachment and social bonding, factors that are really important in terms of relationships. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter also stimulated, and that has to do with craving and desire, you know, and just needing to be with that person. And so when we kiss someone, well, there's a rise in dopamine. It also has to do with novelty. So the novelty of a first kiss can really spike your dopamine levels in a huge way. And then also things like serotonin, which has to do with obsessive feelings, obsessive thoughts about the other person, a variety. It's a cocktail of hormones and neurotransmitters that sort of guide us and help us decide our next move.
That was Cheryl Kirshenbaum, author of The Science of Kissing. Thanks, Lindsay.
You're welcome.
Earth Sky is Lindsay Patterson, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Lara Skye, Clear Voice for Science. We interview the world's top scientists. The continent of Africa faces tremendous challenges to feed its people. Calestous Juma is an expert on science and policy and a professor at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. In late 2010, he met with five African presidents to present his latest report on rejuvenating Africa's farming through the latest in science and technology. Dr. Juma, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Now, you assert in your latest book, The New Harvest, Agricultural Innovation in Africa, where over 200 million people suffer chronic hunger, Africa can transform its farming within a generation to fully feed its people. What's happening here?
What's happening is that it's really a new age in which Africa has a huge advantage as a latecomer. It has access to a large body of scientific and technical knowledge that was not available to its predecessors, which it can harness and put to use. Secondly, it's relying very heavily today on building a new network of economies, basically creating regional economies where various African countries are starting to trade together as economic blocks. And one of the areas they're starting to focus on is agriculture. And thirdly, we have a new generation of African leaders that are very focused on economic transformation, and they would like to start with agriculture.
This access to science and technology. Tell us more about that. What's new? What's happening?
First, take mobile communication. This is something that was not really accessible to Africans, and it's playing a very important role now in extension services where farmers are starting to share information about markets, about rainfall, about prices, which enables them to manage and make decisions on when to grow crops, which crops to grow, and which markets to take them. So it's offering them some degree of flexibility that was never available to them before, because in the past, they needed an agricultural extension officer to drive to their communities to tell them what was happening. They don't need that anymore. So information and communication technologies has dramatically changed the way we do agriculture. They are also connecting with new technologies like satellite imagery, where they are linking up with high-tech institutions that provide up-to-date weather forecasts. And this is basically helping them to stay abreast with the latest developments, both in the ecological field but also on the market front. And then we have other new technologies like genetically modified foods, which is a little controversial, but we are starting to see African countries start to adopt it, especially in the area of cotton production. Three African countries, South Africa, Burkina Faso, and Egypt are already growing GM crops. And they're doing it because they make economic sense for farmers. These are technologies that were not available to Africans, say, a decade ago.
Right, and I was hoping you'd give us some more examples from the New Harvest, this report that you've collected, some examples where agricultural production is working in Africa.
Malawi is a very interesting case because this is a country which for decades used to be used as a laboratory to study malnutrition. And about 7 years ago, a new president comes to office, President Mutharika, and basically decides that as a president, he was going to take responsibility to leverage existing technologies and bring them to farmers. And what he did was very simple. Was basically provided seed and fertilizer to farmers. But he went further than that. He gave modest subsidies to enable farmers to get started. And he managed to turn around production in Malawi, literally in a year. And the following year, Malawi was a net exporter of food. In fact, it's projected that this coming year, Malawi will, in fact, continue to remain a net exporter of food. And this is remarkable because this is a country that was very well known for hunger, malnutrition, starvation, and all that. And that model that he's used is being emulated by other African countries.
That was Calestous Juma, professor of the practice of international development and director of the Science, Technology, and Globalization Project at Harvard University. His new book is called The New Harvest. EarthSky is a clear voice for science. Find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. This is Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Ryan Britton is here to tell us a story about weird science on the club-winged bird. Ryan, what's going on?
Right. So scientists found fossils in Jamaica of an extinct ibis. Now, an ibis is a kind of bird with long legs and long curved beaks that are often found, you know, wading in shallow water. You know, we have them around today. But this particular extinct ibis was a serious fighting bird that developed these heavy bone structures at the end of their wings that they use for beating and bludgeoning their rivals and predators.
Yeah, and when I think of a fighting bird, I think of an eagle or something with talons and sharp beaks. But we're talking about some kind of they're bringing out the heavy clubs now.
Exactly. So if you picture at the end of their wings this heavy club instead of a delicate tip of feathers that you see in modern birds that have wings for flight. That's what these ibises had. These curved bones were shaped like, you know, really heavy bananas. It's sort of how they've been described.
So how do scientists know that these club-winged birds used their clubbed wings to fight with and not to help each other out, you know, crack open a nut or something?
Right. So the most compelling evidence that scientists found was that these bones had fractures in them. The fossil record showed fractures in these heavy bones that showed that, you know, they hit things hard enough to break them. So, you know, this is pretty serious business. They definitely, you know, took and received blows. And also, what's interesting is that modern ibises, you know, today's ibises, they fight. When they're protecting their territory or fighting over food, they can grab a rival with their beak and they strike with their wings.
And so these clubbed winged, you know, dangerous birds.
Well, I don't know if they were dangerous. They're really 5 pounds. So they're sort of small, but, you know, maybe dangerous to each other.
People listening, they went extinct. So, violence with clubs doesn't always pay off.
Right. Evolutionarily, maybe not. Because the interesting thing is that scientists have not found any other vertebrate in the world that has modified limbs. And when I say vertebrate, I mean an animal with a backbone. That have formed, you know, club-like appendages, formed natural weapons, you know, at the end of their arms. So they've never seen anything like this before.
So Ryan, where can people find out more about the club-winged bird?
Well, there is a really great article by Lindsay Patterson, our own Lindsay Patterson, on our website at earthsky.org. She has some really great pictures of these bones, you know, comparing it to the wings of modern ibises. There's also a great article on lifescience.com.
Weird science, club-winged birds. Thanks, Ryan.
You're welcome.
Earth Sky's Ryan Britton. And we're Earth Sky, clear voice for science.
Animal behaviors in the everyday, each and every city, state, county, country, avenue, and driveway. Rational behaviors make the system tick, makes the human do the trick, earn the pay, procreate and quick fade. Animal behaviors.
This is Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We interview the world's top scientists. Beth Lebwohl is here in the studio to tell us about a new map of the fruit fly genome that was done by a computer scientist at MIT, and this map has implications for human health. Beth, what's going on?
Well, I spoke to Dr. Manolis Kalis at MIT, and he, over the course of 4 years, worked with about 100 other scientists, ranging from geneticists to folks who are called bioinformatics experts, on creating an ultra-sophisticated map of the fly genome.
Well, yeah, maybe you could explain for people listening here, what exactly is a genome and what does that have to do with the gene? What is all that?
That's a great question. A genome is something that all animals have. We have one in every cell in our bodies. You can think of it actually as a book, and that book contains the sum total of our hereditary information. And it's actually made up of letters, which are A, C, G, and T. And those letters are actually abbreviations for nucleic acids. And nucleic acids build our DNA, and DNA builds our protein, and proteins are what make our bodies work, and so on and so forth. So in essence, the genome is a book in each of our cells that enables life. But the catch is that it also enables disease. Here's Dr. Kalis.
And when one of these letters goes wrong, you could end up having a disease, or you could have a predisposition for a disease. You may be much more likely to get cancer if one of these letters changes.
So, Beth, this work that Dr. Manolis Kalis is doing with fruit flies, mapping out their genome, what does this have to do with humans and what's inside of humans, the human genome, and apparently diseases? What's happening here?
So they've developed certain methodologies and systems and big supercomputers that help them analyze genomes. They have a certain methodology in place. And in 2011, they're going to use that same methodology for creating a sophisticated map of the human genome. And the human genome is made up of letters, 3 billion of them. And when a letter is wrong, that's when disease can happen.
We can now say, aha, that letter falls in this region, which we know carries out that function, and we know is interacting with that other, you know, gene far away that it sort of corresponds to, that it talks with, and therefore make a prediction about what genes to target with a particular drug when we have a particular disease.
That was Manolis Kalis of MIT. Earth Sky's Beth Lebwohl, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We're taking your questions on Facebook. To find us on Facebook, search for Earth Sky. Now for a report on the entire world. Lindsay Patterson is back to tell us about the State of the World report of 2011 by the World Watch Institute. Lindsay, tell us what's going on here.
Every year, the World Watch Institute, which is a think tank based in Washington, D.C., comes out with their annual State of the World report, focusing on trends in sustainable development. This year, they're focusing on agriculture, how the world is going to feed itself. And so for the past 2 years, they've had a project called Nourishing the Planet that has visited 25 different countries in sub-Saharan Africa. That's one of the hungriest places on the planet. I spoke with the director of the World Watch Institute, Christopher Flavin.
This year, we focused on food and agriculture, and our conclusion is that the world faces an enormous challenge in terms of meeting a growing world population, but that by employing new innovative practices to really focus on smallholder agriculture in the poorest countries, that there's the opportunity to make real progress both on hunger and on world poverty.
So can you tell me more about the project that that came up with the findings for this report, Nourishing the Planet?
This is a project that the Gates Foundation was our major partner in, and the purpose of the project was to look at solutions to the world food problem that go beyond the more productive seeds and fertilizers, which of course are already the focus of a lot of international development efforts. And some of the major innovations that we think really need more attention are, first, to really focus on conserving soils and using water more efficiently. There is an enormous problem in terms of lack of soil fertility and lack of water. And a lot of that problem can be alleviated by simply focusing on better conservation practices and developing, for example, small amounts of irrigation water locally. And then finally, we think that there needs to be more focus on urban agriculture. You know, a lot of the world's hungry are in cities, and farming is something that does not have to be just in rural areas. There are a lot of plots lots of land available that you can really develop a significant local food, even in large cities.
And so can you give me a few examples of the kind of solutions and innovations that the project investigated?
Well, we looked at some very, very, exciting small-scale efforts, for example, to develop the drip irrigation, where you develop irrigation on a very small scale using some of the latest technologies that have been developed. We've also looked at programs for reducing food wastage that have been pioneered by non-governmental organizations in a number of African countries. We've also looked at school feeding programs, and in some cases programs where children themselves can actually participate in the food production. All of those have been enormously successful in reducing hunger and poverty.
That was Christopher Flavin, director of the World Watch Institute, on the 2011 State of the World Report. And thanks, Lindsay, for telling us about it.
My pleasure.
Earth Sky's Lindsay Patterson. That's our show. Thanks for joining us. We recorded this week at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers, Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, The Black and White Years, Daniel Webb, 100 Flowers, Wire Tree, and The Bright Light Social Hour. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much hype, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age.